So are we all back?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
Fantastic. So do we, you know, while we're still waiting for a couple of people to assemble, hopefully we'll have a better quorum, and then we'll get to Gene's presentation. And Gene, if you wouldn't mind, I think it's probably better that you introduce yourself. You'll do a better job than me. When you begin. But thank you for joining us today. So, do we, and obviously, you saw the notes. This is Frank Niepold. I'm stepping in for Tamara to share the lead on the network call, and we are recording. So, just you know, remember that. Do we have any announcements for us today? Really? Either we're very quiet, or we're just too busy that we're tired. Scott, can you just tell? I'm actually curious. What were you doing that has now got you so tired? Is it related to Clean Network?
Somewhat. I was out with our Geodome, which is a portable planetarium. And we were doing shows at two major conferences in the Bay Area. So one was Bioneers, which is a group that does, it's been around for about 24 years and is a group of sustainability people. And then I just came back from San Jose, which is a conference on science and non-duality, which is quite interesting. I shared that with Frank because I know of his interest in some of those matters. So it was a very interesting conference with a couple of big names. Deepak Chopra was there, Matthew Fox, a whole slew of Peter Russell, folks that you, names you may know. So it was a very big, interesting conference, and we do shows, which are mostly programs that are based on using the Digital Universe Atlas from the Hayden Planetarium. So we use that to, as conversation starters. But it's exhausting.
It is. Well, yeah. The reason why I ask is sometimes there's you know, some people see the Clean Network in a kind of a smaller way, and sometimes there are members who push that to be much more expansive. One of the projects that is out there is the World Views Network, which kind of takes the ideas that we talk about in this and just pushes it out into a larger space. And I think it's a rich. I wonder, Scott, if you agree that we should have the World Views Network present to the Clean Network sometime.
Absolutely, and you know, we're sort of peripherally engaged with them, though that funding has disappeared. That's finished as a NOAA environmental literacy grant, but it's a collection of planetaria around the country and what's now called the Story Dome that I'm associated with is sort of is a portable planetarium, but we work with the same folks. So David McConville, who used to be on this call quite a bit, certainly is somebody who could talk about sort of a wrap-up of what the World Views Network has done over the last 3 years with its grant and what it hopes to do in the future in a more informal fashion. So I saw David last week, certainly could approach him for that.
I think it would be great.
Yeah, I think so. And so, I agree, you know, part of why I'm interested in using these is exactly that public outreach. We can talk to ourselves, but and maybe even in our classrooms. But when you start going after different kinds of audiences, like those that turn up at these kind of conferences that I was at this week, the last 2 weeks actually, it's just another way of reaching a different group of people that you don't normally interact with. And World Views is certainly doing that with whatever the 7 or 8 sites that they have. The kind of programming that they've done on social and environmental issues.
Absolutely. So in the interest of time, are there any other announcements? If not, I'm going to pause and let it be there. All right. So if not, Tamara did ask me to remind everyone that that there is a press release that is sent out to the network about a day and a half of climate literacy sessions at the GSA meeting. That's where Tamara is and why she's not with us today. I imagine there's a bunch of our community that are there as well, giving talks to the GSA community. So good work to follow and see what we can learn from that. Gene, maybe we should just move over to your presentation, if you don't mind. So please introduce yourself for us.
Yeah, sure. Hi, everyone. I'm Gene McGregor, and let's just do a sound check. Can everyone hear me all right?
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
Good. Great. So it's a great pleasure to share some findings of a survey that we conducted last spring with college and university faculty members in our region. I'm on slide one of the PowerPoint that I hope you all downloaded, and my plan for the call and this presentation is first to give a context for this work by telling you a little bit about myself and curriculum for the bioregion, the project I direct. Second, to describe the survey we conducted last spring and some of its results. And third, just to invite conversation and your feedback. I should also mention that the full report of the survey that we did is on the link on the Clean Teleconference page along with this PowerPoint presentation. So the next slide, slide two, tells a little bit about the Washington Center for Undergraduate Education at Evergreen. I helped to create it in the 1980s as a public service office of Evergreen to build partnerships with faculty members across the state of Washington, but now it's a national center, partnerships in the 2- and 4-year system with the objective of strengthening undergraduate teaching and learning and student success in college. We are most well known around the country for our leadership with learning communities, curricular learning communities, and I know that there's different definitions of learning communities in K-12 education and higher education. But in higher education specifically, we're talking about strategies for enrolling students, cohorts of students in linked or clustered classes that are organized around interdisciplinary themes and questions. And the Washington Center is kind of the national resource center for that work. We get modest, really modest funding from the state for a small staff and for special projects like the one I direct now, curriculum for the grant, bioregion, we're grant funded. So to slide three, curriculum for the bioregion is in its 9th year, and this sort of pulls together my interest in both undergraduate course improvement and faculty development with my background in environmental studies. So our ultimate objective is to foster sustainability literacy in undergraduates, but our specific strategy for that is engaging faculty members in professional development experiences and curriculum development projects. So we've worked across the state of Washington, but our primary active campuses are right here in the Puget Sound watershed. Slide four. Here are the questions that we're all grappling with, I think, all across the nation, but this is what we grapple with specifically in this project. Taking a cue from Jim Elder, I often ask the question when I give talks, what century are we preparing our students for? A huge amount of the curriculum, as we all know, is preparing students for the century that already went by. And the education we want to undertake is not just the cognitive endeavor of building knowledge and skills, it's also an affective challenge involving students' feelings and attitudes, and a moral imperative that can lead to responsibility and to action taking. And we're very clear about that in all of our workshops, that we want to work on all those fronts at once. And we ask the third question because unless faculty members across the discipline see the relevance between sustainability concepts and the disciplines they teach, the whole idea of sustainability is just going to remain on the margins. Here are assumptions about putting environmental and sustainability learning in place. We think that local knowledge is the basis for understanding larger issues of global change. And within this framework, experiential learning in the local can have important meaning for us. When we were planning this project, our research revealed that while students in this region are fairly concerned about environmental quality and a sustainable future, their environmental literacy and their knowledge levels of their own bioregion are remarkably low. So slide six, this is a quick visual summary of our entire strategy and our project work. So I know this is a little bit complicated to look at, but every blue bubble in this visual represents a grant, a project, a field course, a workshop, or a faculty learning community. So going around the circle from the top, with a number one circle, some of our projects, and really most of them, have focused entirely on ways to integrate sustainability concepts into undergraduate liberal arts courses. And we do that through inter-institutional faculty communities, so have done one in chemistry, one in philosophy, one in sociology, one in math, et cetera, et cetera. And then also have provided seed grants to campuses to create their own faculty communities on their campuses doing curriculum integration projects. The second strategy, going around the circle clockwise, mentions projects or workshops that engage faculty members and often students as well with a particular issue and building faculty members' capacity to teach that issue in all its complexity. And a really essential component of these projects are the community experts we bring in. And they can be from local or federal government, Indian tribes, nonprofit groups, or the business sector. And then the number three strategy is less focused on a particular topic, but rather on teaching strategies for student engagement and learning. And the most long-standing work here is the Sustainability and Contemplative Practice Faculty Learning Community, which has been meeting regularly for 4 years and is now actively working on a book on weaving reflective practices into sustainability education. But we've done projects around teaching cases and projects around service learning and this whole idea of curriculum integration as well. I'd say that our most successful programs have been built around faculty learning communities, and these are groups of 20 to 30 individuals who commit to meet over time, usually a year, but sometimes longer, to support one another in developing curriculum ideas. We're really fortunate in the Puget Sound region that there's a large concentration of colleges, so faculty members can easily carpool to meetings, or even, in some cases, bicycle to meetings, which are often on college campuses or at very low-cost retreat centers, such as here, the University of Washington's Pack Forest. And another really key element to success, I think, has been learning in the field, the opportunity to interact experientially with the issues and with expert citizens and professionals. We've involved about 100 faculty, for example, in a project that's gone over several years called Sound Learning Communities, and it focuses on restoring and sustaining Puget Sound's health. Just a little bit about me and my path into climate change work. My background is environmental studies, and my early career was in nature centers and science museums, but then I kind of morphed into a public involvement facilitator around environmental rulemaking, and then migrated into higher education. I got active in alternative energy projects in the 1970s. I was a director of education in a science museum, and then subsequently directed a VISTA project in the southern mountains of North Carolina, which was focused on building solar greenhouses. And through that, I began weaving energy studies into environmental studies classes at Warren Wilson College near Asheville, North Carolina. And that was during the Carter administration years, and then I had a wonderful opportunity to serve on the Environmental Advisory Committee to the U.S. Department of Energy. And then more recently, in 2009 and 10, I worked on the development of the NSF-funded project called CAMEL that's been mentioned in a few of these phone calls. It's based in the National Council for Science and the Environment. And as I developed the curriculum for the Bioregion project, climate change kept coming up as a constant in lots of our workshops and conversations. And over again, faculty members said that they were really eager to strengthen their climate change teaching. And so that sort of pushed us as a community to really move now into developing a full-blown project. But in the Washington Center, now we're in slide 10, the way we start projects is not just by launching them. We first often spend as much as a year or 18 months listening to our constituents, figuring out where we should be starting from, who can serve as project partners, what people see as their aspirations for a project, as well as the barriers they're facing. Our curriculum for the Bioregion Project has a steering committee of 24 people who represent 18 of the colleges and universities in the area and also several regional organizations. So together we designed the survey around these kind of overarching questions. I'll just let you look at them.
Jean, is it possible, would you rather hold questions to the end, or do you want to do more?
Let me just take a breather right now before we go ahead. Anybody want to ask questions now, and then we'll go a little further and listen for questions. I'm completely flexible.
Okay. I have one, but I'll let others go first.
There's just something that I noticed in last week's conversation. One of the things that was coming up was the importance of a network of networks. And I'm just looking at Jean's representation of all of those different communities of faculty interlocking together. So I would just notice at this point that there's different ways of representing those network of networks and that we're seeing that pattern appearing more and more often. So I just want to affirm how important this presentation is in the context of last week's conversation.
Absolutely agreed. So, Jean, unless there are other questions, all right, hearing none. If you could come back to, on slide 4, you put forth kind of a bounding concept. You know, there's the century for the environment, which I support as well. But this idea of bringing together sustainability literacy, responsibility, action-taking, leadership, knowledge and skills, and then combining that with the first bullet of this on slide 10 about who is teaching climate change, because it opens up a wider, you know, usually when you would think about that, you would think about somebody in the atmospheric sciences or geography department or earth sciences, you know, geosciences who would be teaching that. But and when you take that larger frame, it actually grows the answer to this to a much more diverse group of teachers. Do you see that showing up in your work?
Yeah, just keep watching.
You got it.
That's exactly what this is about. Yeah. So, excellent question, and you'll see a lot in the answers. So, other questions that people want to, or comments right now? Yeah, this is a really ambitious project we have. It's a real tiger by the tail, I have to say. But we really are thinking big, and we are thinking that. And, you know, Kathleen Dean Moore, with her wonderful work at Oregon State University and her fabulous book, Moral Ground, has been a real touchstone for us about really broadening our thinking about who should be on deck for this work. And so, although I come from a science training, I've really broadened out as I've done this work. Okay, so we're on slide 10, and so these were the questions we asked, and this is how we went about it. We developed a short SurveyMonkey survey, and we really worked to try to keep it very short with sort of three questions, just name and contact information, and do you want to get a report of what we learned. And we just trimmed this. So, of course, as we did the survey analysis, we went, oh, phooey, we should have asked this question and this question and this question. And it always happens when you look at your survey results. You're filled with regret about what else you wish you'd asked. But anyway, so we had it up for about 3 months. We knew that by spring quarter of last year, we would really be fighting survey fatigue. I don't know about you and your work situations, but in the past 3 weeks, I've been asked to fill out 6 surveys, some mandated by the state, some coming from professional networks, some from a couple of graduate students who want to, you know, have professionals take a survey. So we went into this knowing we might have a kind of uphill slog getting any interest at all, but we were really gratified that we got a pretty good participation. And so the way we went about this is we asked our steering committee members and campus liaisons simply to get the word out and to invite colleagues to take the survey. And I know that some put it out to an all-faculty list on their campus, and others just invited the usual suspects and their colleagues who are interested in sustainability to take it. So we knew it was not a random survey. These are interested people who took this. And interestingly, about a fifth of the people said they weren't teaching about climate change now, but they wanted to be, and they filled out the survey. They didn't obviously report on what they were teaching. They were jumped in the survey to the end about what would you like to see or what would you like to get. So let's go to slide 13, and that displays the campuses with the highest faculty participation. And what we learned here was that there was absolutely no correlation between the size of the campus and the number of faculty completing the survey. For example, the largest community college in the state, which has 20,000 students, had a very, very low participation in the survey. And smaller colleges like Evergreen on the left and Centralia, which is a community college on the right, had fairly strong degrees of participation. So this was all about faculty members urging their colleagues to take the survey. Slide 14 breaks out faculty by discipline. So predictably, the STEM disciplines were the most represented. We did get some fairly good participation from faculty in social sciences and arts and humanities disciplines. There were, additionally, a small number of faculty in professional technical fields such as energy management, horticulture, nursing, teacher education. Another small cohort identified themselves as interdisciplinary people, and that, of course, includes a lot of Evergreen faculty, but also we have several universities in the region with interdisciplinary programs that are quite large, and so it's not surprising to have people self-identify as interdisciplinary. So we asked, where does climate change occur in the classes you teach? And, of course, we see that it's in a wide array of courses, and it's both in lower division and in upper division. So predictably, introductory courses and gen ed courses, but also upper division courses primarily in ecology, environmental science, atmospheric science, applied science classes. Slide 16 lists some of the disciplinary areas where climate change is being taught. And our sense is that, of course, it's a topic within large introductory classes in the sciences, such as biology, chemistry, geoscience. But it's also a focus in upper division environmental sciences, as I mentioned before. We were impressed that entire courses or learning community programs about climate change are appearing on many, many campuses. But then Washington State is a state where the impacts of climate change are very much on people's minds. It's in the newspapers a great deal. It's in a region of the country where environmental stewardship is a pretty strong cultural norm, at least in Western Washington. And also, there are many campuses with interdisciplinary missions and programs. But the survey results also revealed that climate change is taught in another of other places on campus, which we think is really promising. But nevertheless, 70% of the courses mentioned were in the STEM disciplines. One of the most important questions we asked faculty was to give us some sense of to what degree are they giving emphasis to different topical areas. And we provided 17 different topical areas. And for each one, we asked faculty to use a scale from 0 to 3. And I'm going to show you the topic areas. But in the upcoming slides, we'll be showing this scale. So just take a moment and go over it so you keep it in your head. 0 means no emphasis. 1 is not in any depth. I mention it, but not in any depth. 2 is modest emphasis, and 3 is significant. So you get the range. And here are the topical areas. I'll just give you a moment to look through these. And so you'll see that a few of them are in yellow, and we're going to return to them in what I'm now about to show you. So everybody take a deep breath, because now it's like graphs and data. Okay, slide 20 presents the emphasis of all the faculty are teaching now about climate change, and you can see the topics getting the most emphasis to those getting the least. And just make note here of all the topics whose mean score is 1.5 or less. That means that these items are just barely getting mentioned by most faculty. Barely getting mentioned.
So the moral dimensions of climate change is below 1.5. It's the first one
below.
Yep,
it's low. Yep.
Right.
Moral
right.
dimensions, climate change denial, collective responses and movements, media, policy, business community, emotional dimensions, geoengineering solutions, and arts and humanities responses. And that last one, I realize arts and humanities responses is a truly lame phrase, but we couldn't think of anything else to try to collapse in things like, there's actually courses in the state on things like CLIFI, which is science fiction about climate change. Who knew? Anyway, let's go to faculty who are teaching entire courses or learning community programs about climate change. This is slide 21. Understandably, these are really science-heavy courses, and all the topics are getting obviously higher emphasis, but it struck us as notable that the emotional responses to climate change, whether this might be students' responses, faculty members' responses, society's responses, is the lowest one.
Yeah.
You'd think an entire course on this would not take this up? It's being taken up, but again, not very deeply and not very many people mentioning it. Okay, so if you're still with me, the next few slides are going to take a closer look at some of the topic areas specifically.
Just one quick question here. Between slide 20 and 21, what's the step down in number? Because I would imagine 20 is the largest number of courses, but then the slide 21 is a subset
right.
of and how small is that subset? Do you remember?
Right. Let me do a just quick calculation on a calculator, and I'll tell you that's a great question. So probably 240 people were filling out slide 20, and 21 would probably be 30 people, 30 to 40
yeah.
people. That
okay.
help?
Okay. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay,
I have a question also.
Okay.
It seems like that on both of these that the science or scientific topics rank higher, and the humanities and social science tend to rank lower, with the exception of geoengineering solutions, which is low
right.
on both of the plots. And do you know why that is?
We talked about that, and our best guess was that maybe faculty members in different biological disciplines might not know much about the geoengineering solutions that are in the air. It
mm-hmm.
seems like a lot of atmospheric scientists know a whole lot more about that, but maybe it's just not being taken up. But I really think I'm going to get to this toward the end of the presentation. I think the time window for teaching this within classes that are really broader classes, like intro chemistry, is pretty small. The window is small. And so they can't get to all the dimensions they probably would like to if they had more time. So let's go on to these topical areas. So slide 22 shows the emphasis that faculty in different disciplines give the science of the phenomenon. And perhaps one reason these numbers are not even higher is that climate change, as I said earlier, is part of a larger course, so it might be covered at a modest level if you only have a week to deal with it, or maybe 2 weeks within a whole term. Predictive impacts is an obvious one that mostly is taught at whenever climate change is taught, and you can see it's higher. Mitigation strategies getting less emphasis. We're below 2 now. Adaptation getting less. Slightly more than mitigation, but less. policy. Terrible. Even less emphasis and very little emphasis given by STEM faculty. But the faculty identifying themselves as interdisciplinary not doing much better with respect to teaching policy or anything about policy.
That stuck out big time.
Right.
Yep. Okay, collective responses, social movements associated with climate change. Strong for humanities and arts faculty, fair for social science and interdisciplinary, but really paltry for STEM and professional technical faculty. And I think this raises a really important question about our climate change teaching. Are we focusing so much on the science of the phenomenon that we're leaving the students with a perception, or really the misperception, that nothing's being done about it, or even worse, that nothing can be done about it?
So,
and there's a lot of emphasis, of course, on individual responses, but, you know, we can drive Priuses till the cows come home. And unless we go to the collective level of things, we're really not going to achieve societal change. And yet,
you know,
there are social movements now, and in the faith-based communities and a lot of nonprofit groups, there's a lot going on, and there's a particularly a lot going on in our region in Western Washington, most especially because the coal train issue is so present for everyone here.
Well, one thing, Jean, that this, your work is presenting is the student's perspective about what they want to learn, that is maybe different than what is being presented for them to learn.
Yes, and that's a tremendously good idea of, and we've actually been discussing, now that we have a faculty survey, could we ask all the faculty members who are interested in this to now ask their students to take a survey also, just to really
right.
do the little, to see what the match or the mismatch might be.
Yeah.
And really use the Six Americas question to really see where they fall.
And then you could match it with those responses too.
Yeah. Okay, shall we keep going here? We have just a couple more
please.
Of these in case you get graph fatigue here. Slide 28 is about climate change communications and discourse about climate change in the media. So now we're just barely hitting 1.5 with social science and even less for everyone else. And I think probably all of us on this phone call know how important communications about climate change is. And yet the emphasis on this on the part of everyone is very low.
Yeah, this reminds me of something Matt Nisbet in one of our early conversations had was about media literacy and the ability for students and citizens, future students and citizens, to be able to navigate the media space in a scientifically sound way. Is where does that show up? And clearly, it's more in the social science humanities, but it's it's striking that it's not very strong in the interdisciplinary piece. But there it is.
Yep. Okay. Well, last graph. So, this is the actual phrase, examining different emotional responses to climate change, exploring apathy, despair, hope, and resolve. So here, the arts and humanities folks, which of course was a very small N within the whole sample group, they're stepping up to it a little bit more, but if we're getting towards zero, that means I don't even mention it, right? So the attention to this is really, really low. And yet whenever I convene faculty, one of the main things they want to talk about is students' emotional responses to learning about climate change and their own, faculty members' own emotional responses to it. I mean, this is the elephant in the room, and we need to confront this much more directly in whatever project we build. So slide 30 portrays the results to a question about community-based learning and service learning. And there's some notes in the notes below the slide with some specific data. But What we learned here is that when faculty or this group of faculty is teaching about climate change, they are, for the most part, not making linkages with the local, with service learning projects, field trips, with community-based learning or research. I mean, the numbers were so, so small. And again, this is a huge opportunity and a huge gap in terms of faculty members really linking what they're learning to what's going on locally. So I just worry for many that climate change remains kind of an abstraction for a lot of students. Slide 31. So 19 of the 30 or so campuses that were in this sample are signatory campuses to the American College and University President's Climate Commitment. And I'm guessing people on the phone call know about this climate commitment project that's run by Second Nature in Boston. But most people are aware of it.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, so we wanted to know what sorts of initiatives were underway on campuses because, you know, all the ACU PCC campuses are supposed to build and also report on, quote, broad-scale climate change education and sustainability across the curriculum initiatives. So we wanted to ask what's happening on your campus with respect to that and what's happening beyond just the routine support for faculty members to travel to professional meetings or routine summer stipends for individual faculty to develop a new course. And what we saw was only a handful of faculty respondents named initiatives on their campus. So my question is, did they not know about them? I don't think so, because I look at the names, I recognize, 60% of the names of people who are filling out this survey, because they've been active in either Washington Center workshops over the years or Curriculum for the Bioregion workshops. And gosh, they were not naming initiatives. So here's just a couple of initiatives in slide 32 that are going on. These are really exciting and wonderful projects. Evergreen has put on 2 TEDx events on climate change that have involved standing room only faculty and students. We're hiring a faculty position in climate justice this year, which is great. University of Washington Bothell, which is out in the suburbs outside of Seattle, small campus but growing one, is offering a new undergraduate degree program called Climate Science and Policy, which is terrific. Whatcom Community College is, I think, the only college in the whole region which has a sustainability requirement for its AA degree. So it's part of their general education requirements package. They're in Bellingham. And also in Bellingham is Western Washington University, and there the interdisciplinary college called Fairhaven is having a themed quarter in winter quarter of this year. And the Whatcom Community Museum is a partner with a major display called Vanishing Ice, which relates to the movie of the documentary film of the same title. So that's super exciting. So slide 33, and I'm getting to the end here. The last couple of slides, I'd just like to mention my experience presenting these results to my steering committee in the summer. So I was going over this data, and it seemed to be such a downer for my group. And this is a really lively group who are leaders on their own campuses, and most of them have been meeting and supporting me for more than 6 years. And so I just said, so, you know, what's coming up for you? What's going on? And it was a very important and I think pretty difficult conversation because a lot of these people who are actually campus leaders were talking about how getting really deeply thinking about climate change puts them in a place of paralysis and feelings of guilt come up, like I'm not doing enough in my life, I'm not doing enough in my classes. So even the leaders are feeling pretty swamped by the emotionality of this issue. Here are just some quotes from some of the people in my steering committee. One is a science dean. His background is geoscience, and he says, the students in community college settings coming in, so few of them understand the science. So I have to start from scratch, and it takes all the time I have just to get them through the science. We can't move on to anything else. Another community college instructor said, a quarter of my students every class I teach think it's a hoax. It's an Al Gore plot. It's interesting enough, faculty in the university settings say they don't see that so much, that almost none of their students are in that place. But community college students, which typically attracts either older students, more conservative students, working class students, students who I guess listen to talk radio, who knows? There's just a lot more skepticism. Lots of scientists have said, I don't want to be perceived as an advocate, so I don't go to policy. I think that's an excuse, because I think you can teach about policy without being perceived as an advocate.
Jane, just on that point, I think if that's a big stumbling block, which I think a lot of us have heard that in many ways, at many levels of teaching, I think that, you know, I don't know what would make them feel more comfortable at the intersection between the science and the implications on society and back and forth. But I think that we as a community need to think that this particular one through very carefully.
I agree. And let me tell you a quick story. A biology and environmental science teacher at Centralia College is not very comfortable with collaborative learning. She says, I'm sort of a tell them and test them teacher. But she took a little risk last year, and she taught her climate change unit in biology for the non-major, biology for the non-major. And then she put students into teams, and she said, come up with some policy suggestions for a week. Just work in small teams for a week. I'll give you class time to do it. And come up with some, what kind of laws should be made? And she said, I don't want you to go online to look at policy because you'll just get confused. Just come up with policies. And she said, I was stunned. They were magnificent, what they came up with. Mm-hmm. And so she said, you know, it's a huge risk for me to do this, but I discovered that they could start figuring things out. Yeah. And they came up with wonderful things like, you know, really stringent fuel requirements for future automobiles and motorcycles, things like that, mass transit support, and, you know, things that we'd think up, you know. But, you know, undergraduate students, really, given some creative time and space, could get very invested and excited in solutions.
Mm-hmm.
One person just talked about, I just teach out of the literature. I mean, I really admit it. And this person was from King County, which is where Seattle is, and I said, so are you involving students in King County's leadership on this? And, you know, Seattle set itself to a goal to meet Kyoto by 2011, and they did it by 2008. Come on, are you teaching that stuff? And he said, no, I just teach out of the literature. And then this really important point, the dean of a library of one of our community colleges said, you know, what from I take from this is, it seems like many people's teaching window is very small because they teach it as part of a larger course. So how can we motivate and enable faculty to widen their window, to get the window open a little wider, to teach it in a more comprehensive way? So that's really, that's my kind of clarion call to move forward. So this is sort of what we're planning on slide 35. As I mentioned at the beginning, we're entirely grant funding, so I'm in project design, and then in winter quarter, I'm going to move into grant writing mode. I'm thinking about setting this up as a series of summer field courses similar to the Sound Learning Communities project, where we convene people in different parts of Puget Sound, really focusing on what's going on in their county, their watersheds. And then really connecting people with different nonprofit groups and networks and municipalities and counties where there are internship and service learning opportunities. And then follow-up meetings to encourage faculty to work together on the student experience and on curriculum development. We post a lot of our curriculum development work. It's modest at this point, not huge, because I'm a firm believer that faculty formation is more important so much than actually publishing curriculum, but we do have a lot of curriculum ideas on the CERC site And I know Colleen is on the CERC site also at Carleton. So slide 36 is the last one, and just want to mention to you all that the highest high tides in Olympia are already licking at our doorsteps in the downtown. So sea level rise is already upon us. And so we really feel that pressure. So I'd like to open it up for discussion at this point. Do these results resonate with your experiences? And also, if you know of other initiatives in higher education that I might connect with, I'd love to know about them. You can write me offline or talk about them now. But I really would like to, you know, learn from the wisdom of some other higher ed initiatives, particularly.
So, Jean, please go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, you.
This is Mona. Jean, thank you so much for this presentation. This is fascinating. There were just so many points in this presentation that resonate, especially the one about scientists being hesitant to get into policy issues. I do think that, certain institutions are now just beginning to confront that issue and also take measures to educate scientists to be better at communicating with non-scientists and the much broader audience. I'm speaking off the Expert Witness Training Academy on this fora, bringing that up. But I'm not sure if you know about it, but that is again one of the initiatives that. It's an academy which was funded by National Science Foundation, but William Mitchell College of Law actually got a grant, and it is training the trainers to be effective communicators and educators. So I didn't know if you knew about that.
Mona, would you shoot me an email and we could set up a phone call and I could learn more from you?
Actually, Jean, I am going to be speaking on that at this forum on November 19th.
Terrific.
I wonder if you have a good one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great. That's fabulous. Wonderful.
So this is Frank Neapold over at NOAA. Your larger question about other activities. That are going on at the undergraduate level. And I think that one of the real questions is, in the American President's Climate Commitment, there are many, many schools who are doing work in this area. But, in my work with Second Nature, it's been really hard to kind of get that coalescing work out. And I would imagine David Blockstein's on the call as well with the Council of Environmental Deans and Directors. And so there's like a different group of people who are working in that space. The second part of the President's Climate Commitment has been the harder part, the teaching part, that, mm-hmm. making your campus carbon neutral is actually easier than getting climate change taught, which is stunning, but at some level I can understand as a teacher. I think that there are emerging pools of activity and expertise. I remember talking with some people at Clark at the University of Maryland and other schools that are doing this, but there really hasn't been a good forum for building that sharing of practice and widening the impact to date within teaching side.
Right, and I think that I think sustainability across the curriculum initiatives on campuses has really taken off lots of places, and there are many, many campuses who are really leading edge on that. And that has largely come through the leadership of the ASHE workshops that Jeffrey Chase and Peggy Barlett have been doing with ASHE for many, many years now. It's quite impressive. But I'm wondering if the sustainability education initiatives have sort of overtaken possible focus on climate change or campus commitments to climate change, campus by campus, to really have campuses really ask themselves, are we enabling every single undergraduate to have opportunities to learn about climate change in a positive way, in a way that really helps them think about their lives as leaders in workplaces, as consumers and commuters and so forth. I'd love to know about those that are really more climate change focused. I think in our state, we have sustainability across the curriculum initiatives that are just bubbling along, partly through the connection to curriculum for the bioregion and partly happening on their own. So that's just great. But I'd love to see entire campuses sort of have conversations about, well, what are we teaching and what are students exiting with? I just got an interesting little anecdote from Richard Louv, who's the author of the, bestseller book, Last Child in the Woods. And he's now on the national speaking circuit about, kids playing indoors so much and so forth. So he's on college campuses all over the United States all the time. And he's reporting that so many of the students who come to his lectures are saying kind of game over, They're just sort of post-apocalyptic in their point of view. And I think that's a really troubling development, if that's as frequent as Richard Louv says it is. Hmm. And that's a real failure on our part, I think.
Yes.
Right. Jean, one of the things we've talked about on this network in the past is linking climate change to, well, we've worked with the Next Generation Science Standards, which have been linking with the math and English language arts Common Core. And
right.
This year, it appears the social science standards have been revised. And it's clear, to me at least, I think at this point, that with the decade that we had emphasizing English language arts and math, that social sciences was not being addressed in those K through 12 levels like they should have been. And so we may have a generation coming forward that, they may be learning things in one way, but they don't get that social science and civic engagement piece. They don't get the doing part connected to the thinking part.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah,
I think,
good point.
Yeah, I really, really encourage what you're doing with getting the faculty in some kind of structure where they're all working together. These professional learning communities are certainly developing at the K through 12 level, and I didn't know what was going on in higher ed at this point, but it seems to me that getting the faculty out of their silos into that kind of commitment will help drive appropriate solutions that reach across engineering solutions and policy solutions, because, just driving the Priuses isn't going to do the job.
So one other question. Go ahead.
Oh, this is Ingrid Zabel. I work in outreach at a natural history museum and a nature center, so I'm not at a university, but I was thinking about the comment about the biologist saying not wanting to teach policy issues because it might be perceived as advocacy. And I think another issue is I'm not sure I would be entirely comfortable teaching policy issues or geoengineering solutions or emotional responses because I just don't know enough about it. I don't know... I don't have a broad understanding of the policy issues or, say, emotional responses. I don't know if there's literature or poetry being written about people's response to climate change. So I think it would be hard to do myself, though I could do a broad brush survey to see what's out there. But maybe it points to doing collaborative projects with other people who do know about those things.
Mm-hmm.
And getting scientists.
You are so right, and this
together.
Is where, you're so right. With our Puget Sound work, having really interdisciplinary groups participate on that and to have time to share teaching and learning ideas, people were just so thirsty for biologists listening to art history people, listening to landscape architects, and so forth. That's what made it so generative, was that interdisciplinary conversations about teaching strategies. You just nailed it.
But, you know, there's another piece to this, which is... go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
I'll be brief here, because we are running up against our hour. A lot of times the big initiatives like the renewable energy adoption at states and businesses, and Costco is put in huge investments in this area. Some reports just came over the weekend, but the problem of climate change and the energy solutions a lot of times don't feel connected, even though they are two parts of one whole. So where that's happening over here in the energy world is the solution for a good chunk of what's happening here in the climate thing. But we teach them as isolated, and they don't fit. So the progress we've made on one is disconnected and thereby disabled from the are we doing things to address this problem. And I think that's something I've noticed often. Many municipal states, countries keep them as isolated things for various reasons, but it does put students in a vulnerable emotional space.
Great
observation.
I would emphasize that point. So I work with Sea Grant, and the very model of Sea Grant is connecting research to education and engagement. Most of the people that work with Sea Grant, most of our professionals are people that are required to be on the ground, talking to people, educating people, learning with them, and teaching them. But at the same time, they come from either a strictly scientific background where they've had no training in social science methods whatsoever. So it just connects back to Jean, your point about emotional connectivity. As a scientist, sometimes you're so driven to learn the science that you're emotionally a little far away from the emotional aspect, the more social human science as human aspects of climate change, and that's an issue, at least in Sea Grant, I can tell you, that we have identified. And so now we have what is called the Sea Grant Academy, where we where people are actually given training on social science methods to help them address these issues more ethically.
Good.
Yeah. So clearly we've hit our hour. It's probably a good sign that we're just charging ahead and wanting to go deeper into this. And so I guess we'll have to figure out a way to maybe transition some of these ideas and these conversations into the Clean Listserv to take it further. Jean, are you part of the Listserv?
Absolutely. I'd be delighted to continue to be connected around all of this, and I'd love to report on what we develop over time. And if anybody has any money lying around, they can throw it over the transom.
I will say, Jean, and David, you were on at the tri-agency meeting. I think the larger clean climate education community is very acutely aware of the funding issues. Sorry, there's some weird echo.
Yeah.
Growing that approach is something that the network is working on. So let's keep on going in the network. Thank you very much for your time, Jean.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thanks, all.
Now.